from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Harvard professor and New Yorker staff writer Jill Lepore's new book, These Truths, is an ambitious new history of the United States. In it, she explores the founding principles of U.S. democracy and the more than 200-year history of attempting to live up to those principles. Lepore connects past successes and failures in U.S. history to today's anxieties over the direction of the country.
People all over the West are watching democracies fall. And fall and fall. And there's this tremendous despair that the great experiment in the liberal state has failed.
Coming up, we talk with Jill Lepore about her new book and what lessons we can apply today. And that's all coming up after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In the introduction to her new book, These Truths, historian Jill Lepore writes, quote, "Some American history books fail to criticize the United States. Others do nothing but. This book is neither kind." Her comprehensive 900-page history of the United States from 1492, actually even before, through the present day, explores how America's history, full of demagogues and technological disruptions, can help shape and inform our understanding of the present. Jill Lepore is professor of American history at Harvard University. She's also a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we welcome her to the program. Professor Lepore, good to have you.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'd like to begin by first complimenting you. This is a remarkable book. It's a huge canvas. It's a sweeping political history and very ambitious. But it's also really, I think, a call to civics. I believe that was your intention. I can say that pretty safely because it comes across that you feel studying the past is a way, as we have elections coming up now and we have all kinds of turbulence coming out of Washington and even in local politics, we need to study the past to understand where we are today. The past is prologue.
Yeah, I do. It is a call to civics. I think of the book as a sweeping narrative account of American history. Best job I could do in 900 pages. But, you know, I describe it as well as an old-fashioned civics book. The call to teach civics better and more often and more regularly, I think, is one that we don't heed and at our peril.
It's a call we need to heed. I am in complete agreement with you, especially in terms of our citizenship. But you also really give a picture of the extremes of narratives and divisions that really holds up for this pluralistic experiment we call the American Republic and the constant swaying back and forth, as is particularly evident in the Declaration of Independence, talking about, as your title suggests, these truths, self-evident. If it hadn't been for a movement of the quill by Benjamin Franklin, they wouldn't have been self-evident.
Yeah, I mean, and I start there because I do think we forget when we celebrate the founding of the country and the importance of political equality that the United States was also founded with a spirit of inquiry. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain rights. But as Jefferson later says in the Declaration of Independence, let these facts be submitted to a candid world. These are assertions that are meant to be subject to inspection, and that is an obligation of living in a republic, or certainly now in our democracy, that it is our obligation to try to sort out fact from fiction and make informed choices as voters, as office holders, as leaders, as members of our community that come from careful scrutiny of the evidence around us and not from the passive reception of information.
Yeah, you make it very clear, though, that this whole American experiment is based on a kind of triad, political quality on the one hand, natural rights, and the people's sovereignty, those working sort of in synchronicity.
Yeah. And the way the book works, I spend a lot of time trying to figure out and explain where those ideas come from. These are not ideas that exist in 1400 or 600 or, you know, in 200 BCE. These are ideas that emerge in the 17th century and reach fruition in the 18th century. And a correction that I try to offer in that excavation of the origins of these ideas, we think they come from brilliant political philosophers, especially John Locke. But they actually come from the protests of people whose rights have been taken away. I mean, that is a piece of the underside of American history that we tend to sort of try to separate out, like, okay, well, there was the Great Founding, but also they were slave owners. As if those two things are not related. As if every enslaved man, woman, and child who ran away wasn't actually declaring independence, wasn't actually saying, you have no right to govern me. By what right? I have natural rights. I am a human being. I own my own life. And I hereby declare and repossess my own liberty, that we fail to understand and reckon with how powerfully those protests of people without power go into that Declaration of Independence. So we still not realize the promise of those founding documents. It is a constant struggle. But I think it's important to understand that their origins are actually a lot more complicated, too.
Yeah, you make that pretty clear. I mean, in terms of, for example, indigenous people, their influence, but also figures that rise above. I'm obviously talking about people like Frederick Douglass and W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King, who you give a good deal of attention to, but also Susan B. Anthony and many figures who really have to do with the whole idea of all men, and I would add women, being created equal. It gets us to a historical notion that's always fascinated me, and I'd like to get you to respond to this. How much is our history as a nation shaped, do you think, by this, what used to be called the great man theory?
Yeah, I think that the history that used to be taught really was entirely shaped by that great man theory, right? We would just, the textbooks that you'd read up through the 1950s are really just a kind of march of presidents and presidencies, administrations, war to war, kind of leapfrog war to war. And then since then, academic historians, especially as women and people of color entered the academy, got PhDs and did research in the archives. It was an incredible explosion of research on the lives of other people besides presidents. We looked at social movements, political movements, the life of the family, women's experiences, and this great deal of now social history that has been written and political history that kind of has taken, it's like almost like a second-class citizenship status to presidential history. Like you turn on the television and you're going to see a bunch of presidential historians kind of nattering on, but you're not going to hear from social historians. And that's an incredible disservice because we know now, living our lives now, we know how important ordinary people's experience is. It dictates what presidents are saying to us on a national stage. We elect those people. We remove them from office. like we know, you and I know in daily life that ordinary people and the societies that we shape and the political movements that we are part of are extremely powerful. So the problem is neither of those accounts of the American past has been kind of integrated. So we still have this just really kind of segregated past. Like on the one hand, there were these presidents. And on the other hand, there are all these social movements and political movements. What I'm trying to do here is put them all together and understand how they inform one another. So just to kind of give an example, I mean, you listed some of the people that I write about, but I write a lot about this woman, Maria Stewart, who I'd never heard of before I started working on the book. And she was a free black woman in Boston who became a preacher and an essayist. She's the first woman to speak to a mixed audience of men and women. And she was an evangelical. She was part of the Second Great Awakening, an incredibly powerful Christian revival in the 1820s and 1830s. And she did a lot to actually challenge Jefferson's notion of equality. And this is what the evangelical movement did for black abolitionists. They said, look, Christianity has a notion of equality. We are all equal before God, men, women, black, white. We are all equal before God. That is what we mean by equality. And that is the challenge that we put to the Declaration of Independence and its notion of equality. We insist that to be equal is for all of us to be equal. And so there's this quite extensive influence of evangelical Christianity on the Declaration of Independence that comes through the voices of black abolitionists, including black women, that I think really changes our notion of who says what and what matters and who are our ancestors. That, I mean, I was just really happy to She belongs on that on the page of that book alongside Andrew Jackson in the 1830s because she tells us so much about the influence that people who challenge received notions can have.
I love this idea of bringing ordinary people in and names that are not in, as the poet Adrienne Rich said, the books that we read, names that simply don't appear. And again, certainly give you high marks for that. I'm wondering, though, and since I mentioned I'm sorry, I think for a moment we may have felt a quake there. I'm not sure what that was. I wanted to also ask you, though, put on my hat, I mentioned Adrienne Rich as American literature professor of many years, if you're also working with a kind of allegory here, or maybe a mythic notion of American history. What I mean by that is, you think of a famous classic like The Great Gatsby and, for that matter, books by William Faulkner, and there's always a sense of some promise that America held, some ideal that became somehow corrupt. It was either corrupt by greed or it was corrupt by particularly the sin of, and I'll use that word advisedly, of slavery and the segregation that followed it, Jim Crow and all of that. I see that unfolding in kind of the bigger gestalt picture of what you're working with here.
Yeah, I mean, what I tried to do narratively to that end was to put people in conversation with one another so that the reader can see how those debate, how those ideas clash. That is to say, you know, the person who's fighting for extending rights, say, to a new group of people who have not had them, and the person who's resisting that extension, and let them both say their piece. You know, they both come on the stage and they argue with each other. So, I mean, the obviously the classic example of this is the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858. But I do that again and again and again, where I want the reader to sort of see how change happened was by people actually listening to one another's arguments and presenting their arguments to the public and letting the sort of the best argument win. Where things get tricky for me, it's interesting that you point to so many writers who were writing in the 1920s, because for me, one of the hardest parts to write was the Scopes trial, the monkey, so-called monkey trial in 1925, where John Scopes, a school teacher, biology teacher, had been charged with the crime of teaching evolution in his high school class in Tennessee. And the great fundamentalist political campaigner, three-time presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan goes to prosecute him, and Clarence Darrow, the great the so-called attorney for the dam, goes to defend him. I had really honestly mainly knew this story from the Inherit the Wind, you know, the great Frederick March, Spencer Tracy film, in which Bryan comes off like a complete boob. And that's how he came off to a lot of historians. But I really, I found kind of fascinating a question that Walter Lippmann asked about the Scopes trial, which is that, and this is the problem with mass democracy as Lippmann identifies it. If we believe two things to be true, one, that the majority should rule, and two, that truth and error have to do battle in a fair field, and then if they do, that truth will always win, what do we do when the majority rules that something that we believe to be true cannot be taught? Do you know what I mean? Like, the people of Tennessee elected a legislature that passed a law that evolution could not be taught in the schools. So how are we going to have a battle of ideas between creationism and Darwinism when the people that are a popularly elected government decided that one of those things can't be taught? That, I don't know, I found that kind of agonizing to write about and to think about how Lippmann struggled with that problem, because in some ways it really is a harbinger of some of our contemporary problems, like, say, climate change, right? Like, if it can't be, we can't agree to figure out how to have a fair argument about that.
But in some ways it is, when you think about, you know, the those, I mean, it gets down to the debate that has continued and raged between those who believe secularism and those who believe religion.
Exactly, right. That's what I mean. Like, that's why it's such an agonizing moment in history was for me to visit, because we're still there.
We are still there. We're still there in so many ways in terms of these divisions. I mean, I was struck by just the detailed nature of what I would call, you know, the battle between those who believe in the Republic and the democratic principles and those who think of the United States as an empire and immigrants versus nativists. And like I said, this is a story about divisions in the wake of what we like to think of ideally as the pluralism of this country. And I think you've really gotten us down to so many of the basics here that we still are facing. When you mentioned, for example, struggling with something like the Scopes trial, it's also the nature of dissent versus maybe majority rule. You mentioned, for example, going back some ways in Georgia, they're passing, and this is a majority again, and the legislators, a state rule that said dissent against secession is punishable by death. That was you think about that in light of the First Amendment, or you think about sedition and alien rules under John Adams as opposed to the kind of fights we're having today. And it all makes a certain amount of sense, but it's all terribly confusing and agonizing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the job of the historian in this case is to try to sort out some of that confusion and focus our attention in certain moments. And those should be ones, I think, that resonate with the contemporary world. One of the things I tried to do in chronicling that evolution was to remind people that our idea of political tolerance, that we should tolerate different political ideas, that we can have two sub-parties, right? This is a new thing in history. a loyal opposition, that we can have an open press, that these things come from the great religious wars of the Middle Ages, that they come from 17th century arguments about religious toleration, sort of like Locke's letters on toleration. Like people begin to say, you know what? You can't actually have the king just tell people what to believe about God and the afterlife and whether we're born in sin or not, because then they don't believe it. They're just being told to hold that view. We believe, you know, the sort of the Protestants who are fighting for religious liberty in 17th century, we believe they do. These are people who believed in one gospel truth, but they believed that if people are, you know, of goodwill, can be exposed to different religious views, this is, we're talking about like Quakerism, Baptism, and then the truth will find its way to them.
But the truth says we are endowed by our Creator, and that puts it in a different context, doesn't it?
So, but that idea, and that extends, that begins to extend to political ideas too. You know what? We should have just let people be exposed to different political ideas, because people are reasonable people. People are, this is the sort of enlightenment confidence, you know, that people can reason their way to the truth. If they just need to see what's out there, and they will make a good decision, so long as they subject different ideas to scrutiny, so long as we can see the ideas competing in an open stage. That idea is foundational to abolitionism. I mean, that is why the Free Labor Party, you know, the party that precedes the Republican Party, the Free Soilers, who are also, they're called the Free Speech, Free Labor, and Free Soil. And the Free Soil, soil that is not in the slave state, right? So they're fighting for those things, and they talk about what in the Bill of Rights is a freedom of speech. They talk about it as free speech because in the slave South, you can't talk about slavery. Like, there's a gag rule in Congress, and you can't publish abolitionist literature in any slave state. There are all these anti-literacy laws. You can't teach a slave to read. Like, there is no free speech in the Confederacy, what becomes a Confederacy, all those states that become the Confederacy. That's where our rhetoric of the free speech movement comes from abolitionism. That if you can't hear people say slavery is wrong, how will you know whether or not to believe slavery is right or wrong? I mean, there's this incredible moment in Frederick Douglass's narrative of his escape from slavery, the first time he hears the word abolition. He'd never heard it before, and he doesn't know what it means, but people say it, and this kind of, it's like a very powerful word, and it's because it's a word you can't say. So, I don't know, I think it's important to reclaim that history, that the ancestry of free speech in our kind of weirdly contentious moment where people are trying to make like partisan political gain by accusing people of being pro or anti-free speech, when it's an incredibly noble and important tradition in the American past.
Well, you mentioned the abolitionist movement. It was certainly in many ways tied to religion, and so was the idea that blacks were the descendants of the curse of Ham. I mean, you know, and all of this in many ways comes to the Civil War and the whole lack of union as a result of the Civil War that essentially brought union back and defeated the Confederacy. But you say in your book, Confederacy lost the war, but they essentially, well, won the peace. Why is that?
Yeah, I do think that's the case. Because Reconstruction was abandoned in 1877 for this narrow kind of party compromise in the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, and the white Northerners agreed with white Southerners to sort of pretend that the war hadn't been about slavery, that it had been about this kind of noble cause of states' rights, and that they are all part of the same political community. That's the, you know, the work that's done in kind of culturally in the half century after the Civil War is the sort of complete erasure of the actual story of the Civil War. I tell the story as told, you know, by other historians. David Blight wrote about this very beautifully in a book called Race and Reunion, the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg in 1913, where the Confederate and Union soldiers, old guys, show up in Gettysburg, very old, and have, you know, tens and tens of thousands of people show up, and they have a big party, and they celebrate that, you know, the Union is back together. The only black people there are janitors and stewards who are serving the food. And Woodrow Wilson comes and gives a talk, and Woodrow Wilson is a segregationist. One of the first things he does when he takes office is segregate the civil service in Washington, bring Jim Crow to Washington, D.C., to the nation's capital. It's incredible moment of racial backwardness.
So let me ask you a very pointed question. What do you think about movements to, for example, remove the name of Woodrow Wilson, as we see now at Princeton University and other places throughout the country, or others who have been participants in segregation and those kinds of things?
I think I think if we set about evaluating people in that way, we're largely engaging in proxy wars that distract us from urgent political battles that need to be waged today. I think we could, for instance, think about the environmental damage that each of us does every day, that you and I are doing today, using the electricity that we're using to have this conversation, as arguably possibly worse for the future of humanity than anything Woodrow Wilson did, we've done in a day. You know, I mean, I think we need to learn about Wilson. We need to subject Wilson to scrutiny. It may be that a community of people that live and work on a campus where there's a building named after him might one day decide to change the name of the building. I mean, these things happen all the time for all kinds of reasons. Myself, as a citizen, I'm not so persuaded that this is the best use of political energies of people who are really concerned about racial oppression.
We're talking with historian Jill Lepore. She's professor of American history at Harvard, also staff writer for The New Yorker, and author of a new book called These Truths, A History of the United States, a monumental work, I might add, and a work that exposes us to many names that we haven't heard before or read in the history books. As we touched on just a few moments ago, I'm also interested in just your thoughts about what we often hear, that things have never been as polarized or never been as chaotic as they are now, particularly under the presidency of Donald J. Trump. Simply not true, is it?
Well, it's not true in two ways. One, I mean, obviously, the country was more polarized when people were killing each other. 750,000 people died in the American Civil War. Two, so long as you include everyone living in the United States in who the we are, who have never been more polarized, there's not a day before emancipation in 1863 that the country was not more polarized. Every enslaved person was in political opposition to everyone who was not enslaved. There is no form of political polarity that is greater than that. There's no form of political suffering that is greater than that. So it's just, I always blanch a bit when people ask that question. It's like, are you, like, okay, if you're talking only about the history of enfranchised white people, then you could make some claim about this is an especially polarized time. But if you want to take seriously that the people who have lived in this country are, we have a common ancestry, that they are, we are all we the people, then you got to adjust that whole notion of what your timeline encompasses. That what is different now, to me, about this particular moment, and certainly as against, say, the 1850s, is that the political divisions that we have today were manufactured in the 1970s and 1980s by political consultants who were very interested in getting voters to the polls and discovered that you could get voters to the polls with two particularly emotional issues, guns and abortion, by creating those issues as emotional issues, that you could polarize the electorate and increase turnout by emphasizing those issues and raising an alarm about those issues. That's what got us to where we are. But in the last 20 years, that polarization has become automated. It's all done by machine. It's very difficult to escape.
And forgive me, you take us right up to the present, in fact, to computers and the like. And let me take this opportunity as we come up on a break to invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation with Jill Lepore. You can do that right now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us, Twitter handles @KQED Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Jill Lepore. She is professor of American history at Harvard University and staff writer at The New Yorker, and her new book is called These Truths, A History of the United States. And as you can imagine, it is a big topic with a huge terrain, and a lot is in it, and a lot couldn't go in it. In fact, Professor Lepore, Bill says, what did you have to leave out of your narrative that you wish you'd had room to include?
Oh, gosh, so much. Yeah, well, those are some really hard calls. I think structurally the one thing I left out that still haunts me, but there was nothing for it, was I wish I'd been able to set scenes physically in places more, you know, where we'd be in the Southwest, and now we're in the Pacific Northwest, and now we're on, you know, on a boat in the Great Lakes. Like, I wish there was some more of the beauty and extent of the country and the continent, and I just had to make a decision. I really wanted to emphasize plot and theme and character, and something had to go. You know, I can't have all that and then also do a lot of stage setting.
Well, let me set the stage here for listener involvement. If you would like to join us, certainly questions about American history or thoughts are welcome in any vein you want to take it. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also, again, email us forum at kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Just some thoughts from you before we go to our callers about the big picture, about the ideals of the Founding Fathers and how relevant they are in your judgment to today?
Yeah, I do think they're relevant. I mean, the way the book works, again, it says like the first part tries to explain where those ideas come from, and then the second part tries to ask whether the nation has lived up to those ideas and the ideals, and the kind of the point of the book is to ask the reader to make that decision, you know, to sort of that is... This is not the kind of history book where I'm offering you, you know, these tablets to send from on high. But instead, here's my evidence and here's the story as I see it. And please, you know, enter the conversation.
But when you talk about those ideals, you're going back, again, using your title here, inalienable rights and rights that essentially were endowed by our creator, or maybe atheists and those who are non-believers would perhaps object to that. But maybe what we're talking about are the higher ideals that were perhaps endowed to those who believe and have faith.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I guess that reminds me. I was giving a lecture once at some part of the country. I can't remember where I was. Well, maybe I was in Seattle, actually. And it was a very contentious moment. It was a sort of Tea Party moment. And I give this little preface before I give my talk because there's going to be a lot of Q&A. And I, you know, I'd sort of learned that this was necessary. But I said to the room, you know, people feel very emotionally about a lot of contemporary political disputes and issues. And I just want to say I really welcome a conversation during the Q&A, but I'm going to ask all of you to be respectful of one another. And to listen to what each other has to say. And we will have, you know, we can have a heated argument, but we have to agree to disagree agreeably. And then people would rise to that and we'd have this lovely conversation. But that one evening, a couple came to me after the Q&A and said, you know, I wanted to thank you for that preface because they were evangelical Christians and they felt that they had been kind of maligned often in public. They'd just moved to Seattle and it's a liberal city and pretty secular kind of town, these events. And they really appreciated that they felt kind of heard and listened to. But they wanted to correct me because I had talked about natural rights. And they said, you know, there is no such thing as natural rights. All rights are given by God. And then they wanted to have a fight with me about this. It's sort of like you say potato, I say potato. Like it's not that there's not an issue, a kind of underlying philosophical matter there, but how this was manifest was like, okay, it was all very nice that you wanted to talk nice, but now let's fight.
Well, there are many words in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence that have been, there's evidence of this sent out to ordinary citizens where they find the words are obviously in their minds put out by Bolsheviks or by, you know, people who are revolutionaries or people who have nothing to do with the Founding Fathers. But there's also that idea of all men created equal, which has caused perhaps more consternation than anybody would have imagined sitting at that time at that place, particularly because men are created equal, but not only men. And by the way, I was fascinated in your book to realize the importance that you ascribe to Phyllis Schlafly in terms of, well, not only conservatism, but just what has become a lot of the feminist revolution of sorts. But I mean, the idea and all that all men are created equal was an idea that just didn't hold where many people are concerned and still doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed, though, to find in a lot of American history textbooks a really honest wrestling with the implications of that. And one of the things I argue, and part of the reason I spend so much time on Schlafly, is that she's so important and has been so overlooked, but also because she allows me to make a case that I make in the book that the failure to ever really fundamentally wrestle with and make a political settlement around the inequality of women is responsible for a lot of the instability of the republic today. I mean, maybe that seems more obvious today than it did just a few years ago to many people. But the Equal Rights Amendment was a necessary measure. Women are not included in the Constitution. The consent of the governed that Thomas Jefferson was talking about was the consent of men to agree to form a government, to be ruled over their public affairs, but that in their private affairs, in their relationships with their women, their wives, their children, their slaves, their servants, that men ruled. It is a monarchy in a household. The republic is where men are equal to one another, but the household is where men rule the way a king rules over his subjects. That is the understanding that was behind the Constitution. So women have fought very hard to achieve equal status under that document. At the moment, only doing so largely through the analogy with race under the terms of the 14th Amendment. And the Equal Rights Amendment, which was first proposed and brought to Congress in 1923, took a really long time to pass. Congress didn't pass till 1972, and Phyllis Schlafly successfully led a movement to defeat it. But a lot of our partisanship is the outgrowth of that movement, and it is just absolutely remains the case that women do not have full equal rights in a named sense under the Constitution as revised.
Now, these founding fathers and Cokie Roberts, a colleague, has done a lot to bring to attention to the public founding mothers and their role, but often in a patriarchal and male hegemonic household, as you've suggested, and by slave owners, so many of them, unfortunately, who talked about all men being created equal. I'm wondering, let me go to our callers. I wonder about some comments that are coming in, but I'll go to those. First, let me go to some callers, and let's hear first from Dan. Dan, you're on.
Hi, good morning. I was interested in the professor's thoughts on the modern Supreme Court and how much power they have and their ability to shape our culture today, and whether or not that's more than the founding fathers ever envisioned. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Jill Lepore.
I spend a huge amount of time in the book tracing the Supreme Court, how the courts before the Supreme Court is formed, and the evolution of the court over the last centuries, because I agree with that, I think, the premise of your question, that a lot has changed and we don't pay enough attention to how it has changed. It is absolutely the case that the court has far more power than it has ever had historically. But it is also the case, and this is a thing I think we overlook, but maybe is quite obvious this week in particular, that the public has more control over the Supreme Court than was meant to have. So the purpose of having the Supreme Court justices be appointed for life and conduct their deliberations in secret was that these are not elected officials and should not be answerable to public opinion. The legislature is answerable to public opinion. The president is answerable to public opinion. The Supreme Court is not meant to be answerable to public opinion. So in many ways, the great corruption of the Supreme Court is not its overreaching for power, but the influence that the public has attempted to exert over the Supreme Court by turning those offices into something that is quite like an elected office. I mean, this doesn't start until 1987 with the Bork campaign, where people opposed to the Bork nomination took out television advertisements opposing his nomination. This, at the time, this was a jaw-dropping development. There's an ad on television about a Supreme Court nomination? What even is that? We forget, for instance, that no justice appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee until 1925, that was Harlan Stone, and only because he'd been charged of misconduct in the Teapot Dome scandal. They wanted to know, like, did you actually do this thing? The next justice to appear before the Judiciary Committee was Felix Frankfurter in 1939. He had first refused to go. He's like, that's just absurd. That's obscene. I mean, I'm not a public figure in that sense, and I'm not running for election. They wanted to ask him if he was a communist. It's not until 1955 that people even regularly appear. And again, not until 1987 that there are public campaigns. So I don't blame the Supreme Court for this development. I blame the party leadership that has decided to wage, to continue partisan battle around Supreme Court nominees so that they effectively are a continuation of our throttle each other to the death partisan politics.
Goes back to Bork. I mean, if we're looking for past, I mean, in terms of just how contentious and how fiery it's been, although when you go back to the earlier part, I want to put a plug in for someone we've had on this program, a local law professor by the name of Joel Richard Paul, who wrote a history of John Marshall and how he changed the court, a biography, actually, of John Marshall. Had an amazing...
Oh, yeah. Marshall basically reinvented the court.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
And also, as long as I'm putting plugs in for people who've been on the show, we had John Meacham on recently, and he talked about American history in terms of finding our better angels, and he was putting an optimistic face on things, even with the turbulent and difficult time we're going through now. That's, of course, takes us back to Abraham Lincoln and talking about better angels and the like, but feels that somehow we will come through. I have a question from a listener, though, for you, Professor Lepore. Rick says, I wonder if the author needed to slant history towards the left in order to sell this text to school districts. In other words, I think what he's saying, did you feel pressure to make it a partisan book?
So this isn't a textbook. I am writing a textbook edition of this book. This is a book for the American public. I feel no pressure one way or the other. I felt an obligation to take seriously partisan claims about the past over time and to inspect them to scrutiny to understand why different parts of the country or different political parties insisted on understanding American history in this way or that at different moments in time, and therefore subjecting our own notion that there is a left and a right version of American political history to a lot of scrutiny as well.
And here's an important question from a listener named Bill. Bill, join us. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. Jill, listen, I really enjoyed history when I was a kid, but I remember I only had it in 1 year of high school, basically. And I was wondering what your thoughts would be on having it a course in history every year in high school. And also, what are your thoughts on how we can make these young kids all over interested in history, especially all the immigrants we're going to get? How do we get them interested in 1744 or whatever? How do we do that?
Boy, that's a big question, and I thank you for it, because I remember when one of the first interviews I did was with Gore Vidal, and he said, how is it that schools make history not interesting? It's fascinating.
Jill, yeah, Laporte, it's really thoughts? Fascinating. Fascinating. I'm hoping our next call is from a woman. I have a general, like, two men, one woman phone call policy. So especially the way that the history as it's told, that March of the Presidents is leaves.
Well, if women want to join us right now, I'm looking particular. At the screen here and I'm seeing all male callers.
Leaves a lot of
let me just give out the number so that you can get your wish fulfilled. It's 866-733-6786. Again, please feel free to call us of any gender. Go ahead, please, Jill Laporte.
So I think it's a, I think the caller is a really interesting point. Part of the diminishment of our attention to the past comes from the rise of STEM, right? The insistence that all American prosperity will derive from teaching the science, technology, and engineering to young people, and that has crowded out all the humanities, including history instruction. And then there's also a deeper, I think, disdain for the past that's part of the culture of Silicon Valley in particular, and the degree to which that affects the nation and its aspirations. It's a kind of reigning principle of disruptive innovation that the past doesn't matter. The last, absolute last thing you would do when trying to design a new technology would be to look at the past. That's considered to be a violation of the principle of disruptive innovation. So I do think that's a
You've just ensured that I'm going to hear from a lot of people in Silicon Valley who will dispute this.
All good. All good.
But I'm wondering about the other part of that listener's question, which is why not have required civics course, history course every year?
You know what? To become a U.S. citizen, you actually have to take an American history test. So I think people have discovered generally that new citizens actually know more about American history and American civics than do non-new citizens.
Here's MC. I don't know what gender MC is, but MC writes, I wanted to know if The Spirit of the Law by Montesquieu is a text that was considered in the development of these truths. If so, what contribution does this text offer to better understand the evolution of political science and modern governance?
Yeah, I mean, Montesquieu was really an influential thinker for the framers of the Constitution, I would say especially Madison and Hamilton, who cite that work. The place that it you can see it influenced in, say, the Federalist Papers would be one in Federalist 10, which is written by James Madison. He's trying to defeat Montesquieu's argument that you can only have a republic in a small country, that in order for people to govern themselves, they actually have to, it has to be a homogeneous people. And so they have to be, live close enough to one another that they share common interests. Otherwise, the country will descend into factions. And so Madison is like, okay, we have a big country, but Montesquieu said we can't have a republic in a big country. But here's my idea. He's trying to defeat Montesquieu. The other place you see it, I believe in Federalist 78, Hamilton cites Montesquieu actually in defense of his argument. Hamilton wants to say, and he's being completely disingenuous, that the Supreme Court, the judicial branch of the government, is the least dangerous branch. He wants to say, and I think this is quoting Montesquieu, that the legislature controls the purse and the executive controls the sword, holds the sword, and the judicial branch has nothing. And he's doing that because a lot of anti-federalists looked at the Constitution. They're like, holy smokes, the Supreme Court has so much power. We didn't want that. And so Madison's like, oh, don't worry. Don't worry. The Supreme Court has hardly any power. It doesn't even have any weapons. He's misrepresenting the case. And of course, as I suggested in response to an earlier question, the Supreme Court takes on a lot more power.
Here's Bill. Bill, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, well, Jill, I believe in the ascendancy of the feminine, but not necessarily the Y chromosome. So hopefully I'm okay talking. Two questions you can answer, whichever one you want. One is context. When we condemn people for their views of the past time, it seems to me we profoundly, profoundly misunderstand and don't understand our current dynamics if we don't put that sort of thing into context. If we do, it helps us so much more understand ourselves now. The second question is, I found generally among historians a kind of pessimism, just as a generalization. And I kind of wonder if that might be that historians don't generally explore the realms of the spiritual, you know what religion expresses. Not a particular religion or its creeds, but that kind of impulse and how important that is to how we've evolved.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, just to say to your first point, I agree with it. Obviously, the more we know about the life, the world that people lived in, the better we understand the decisions they made and can judge what decisions we might have made in their place. With regard to your second question, I do spend a lot of time talking about what used to be called, I think quite beautifully, the American Creed, the idea that our sharing no state religion, that what we do share or are meant to share, is a commitment to these truths, right? Is a commitment to a civic religion. And that it actually is—it's a hard faith, right? And so, it's not easy, and it's not meant to be easy. And I think that's maybe one of the places where we err. A thing that I want to talk about, though, with regard to context, I guess, just to kind of riff off of what Bill suggested, because we also haven't gotten to this point at all. And I'm not joking about, like, it just tends to be the case that men call into these shows, and when I give a lecture, men line up, and I love to hear from all of them. I'm not trying to, like, suppress the contributions and queries being by men, but just frankly to encourage women who...
You've succeeded. We've got a woman caller and we've got women who are writing into us, so we'll go to them forthwith. But finish your thought, please.
Yeah, but what I wanted to say is I think one of the things that a big piece of the American past that's missing that makes the present seem so puzzling is the degree to which I talk about the emergence of the moral crusade as a signal part of American political culture. And that comes from women because all men are created equal, but women are not. And so what women do starting in the Second Great Awakening, inspired by the evangelical revival of the 1820s and their sense of their own power as Christians, is try to reform society by waging a moral crusade. They can't vote, but they can preach. And they can try to persuade people of their position and of the rightness of their position. They fight slavery through the abolitionist movement. They fight drinking through the temperance movement. They fight for women's rights. And that moral crusade is a continuous trend in American history. The Me Too movement is a moral crusade. Phyllis Schlafly's Stop ERA was a moral crusade. The moral crusade is a tool that women created and that men very often use. McCarthyism was a moral crusade. It was saving Christendom from communism. It is a really important and, I think, quite unstable element of how our politics works, and it's an artifact of never really reckoning with the inequality of women.
It was certainly true of Prohibition, too, with all those women temperance, Carrie Nation and all the rest of them. Let me get a woman caller on here. Caroline, join us. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I just wanted to respond to a comment from a previous caller, and also I'm a woman, so calling in, definitely listening here. To the question of, how to get immigrants to be inspired to learn history about this country. And I think it's really about doing things that we can all be proud of. And, if we're proud of where we are and what we're doing in this country, we will want to learn more about it and learn about how we got here and why we got here. And I think, more speakers like yourself to speak about history and enable us to learn that in an easier way, after those school years is what we really need. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for that, Caroline. Jill Lepore.
Yeah, thanks, Caroline. Thanks for calling in. I really appreciate that. And I guess it's worth remembering that our public education system in this country comes as a response to immigration. I mean, in the 1830s, when immigration was on the rise, there were no public schools kind of mandated federally. They're not part of the federal government. But states began providing funding for and opening public schools that were free and open to everyone. partly as they were called common schools. And the idea was the country was really vast. There were all sorts of people living in different parts of the country with different values, different backgrounds. There were a lot of new immigrants, especially this is mainly Germans and Irish that we're talking about at this point, and that there ought to be common schools. People should go to common schools and share an education and get to know one another better. And you can look at that and say, oh, they were just trying to forcibly assimilate the Germans and the Irish. And sure, there are some people that's their interest. But you can also look at that and say, do you know what? Actually, people are really trying to explain the American system of government to people who are new to the country, and also to give people who grew up in the country, who were born in this country, the opportunity to get to know those people from those immigrant groups.
Forgive me, Professor Lepore, I've got to do an ID here and remind listeners that you are listening to Forum and that we're talking with historian Jill Lepore, and that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And did you finish your thought, Jill Lepore? I think you did.
I just gave a little shout-out to the Common School movement.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, let me get Max on next. Max, join us. Oh, I'm sorry. Dee is joining us. Dee, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to respond to the point about how do these texts work in a classroom. And from my perspective, what I've seen is a lot of high school students who really disengage with the study of history because they think of it as the study of dates that really has no relevance to them, and they sort of, you know, shut off. But using this book and a book like David Moss's Democracy and sort of parsing those ideas out to students and letting them engage with the argument from their perspective really does serve a tremendous purpose in getting them excited about historical process and seeing themselves as a part of it. That's all.
Okay. I thank you for that. Let it stand.
Yeah, thanks. That's great commentary. I appreciate that.
Here, Sharon, you got a lot of women callers out here.
Yay.
Jill Lepore. Go ahead, Sharon. You're on.
Oh, hi, I'm Sharon. You know, I really listened in interest because when I was in high school back in 1960, Supreme Court justices, because they were life appointees, were sort of considered, you know, sacred, that they wouldn't be partisan, you know, because they could do everything they want once they're appointed. How do we get back to that? How do we get back to nonpartisan appointees and get out of the political issue with this?
Yeah, can we go home again?
Yeah, no, that is a great question. And I wish I had a great answer. I want to just say you are absolutely right about the shift in our lifetimes. We can think of a lot of justices. I mean, the famous case is Earl Warren, appointed by Eisenhower, and the first decision he makes is Brown v. Board in 1954, and Eisenhower disagrees with the decision. Warren continues to move to the left for the entirety of his time on the court. And, you know, that's fine. Like, Eisenhower's like, oh no, I've made a terrible decision. I must appoint some conservative to the, you know, that's people change. You know, people have this is a lifetime appointment, and there really is a corruption in that process that you can see its origins, you can watch it grow. It's like a monster growing in your bedroom closet. It sort of seeps, starts oozing out from beneath the door, and then it crashes open the door, and now it's like filled up the entire bedroom. That's sort of how it feels to me. It's a very bad situation.
Boy, you know, you use a metaphor of our history being like an infancy and baby teeth in a jar and all that. When you were just describing that monster, I was thinking about, you know, a monster with fangs and everything growing up out of those baby teeth. Let me, getting some comments from women listeners. Molly writes, Jill Lepore is right on about the importance of talking about unfavorable truths, but she is up against a new wave of intolerance. What is her opinion of the story that Ian Buruma, the editor of the New York Review of Books, was let go because he published an essay by a Canadian radio personality describing his experience after being charged and acquitted of sexual assault? I find it alarming that controversial ideas are censored.
Yeah, I guess I find that alarming, too, in a big picture sense. I think we are in an age of tremendous political intolerance that calls itself other things. I think there's a real brittleness to many people's positions about many issues. It's very hard for the machinery of democracy to work when people's positions are frozen. So I'm concerned, too. I haven't followed that story about the New York Review of Books, to be honest with you. I have no comment. I've been grading papers and reading for class, so I haven't really been following that. But I do think there are plenty of other instances. I went to Middlebury College last year to lead a discussion about free speech on college campuses in the wake of you know, an incident at Middlebury the previous year that had resulted in violence. So it's a real concern, and I think it's a concern both on the left and the right. And I, you know, what I say in the book, and I think probably the darkest passage in the whole book, which is not generally a dark book, is that when you think about the peril to the to a free and open exchange of ideas, it's not unfair to say that the left has undermined the university as a place where that happens, and the right has completely undermined the press as a place where that happens.
Quick question, because we only have seconds left. Allison, another woman caller, a listener, says, can Professor Lepore comment on what she thinks the end of Jim Crow happened and what marked its end? When did it happen?
I mean, Brown v. Board in 1954 was a very significant turning point in Brown v. Board. I mean, in the end of Jim Crow. As you see, though, the implementation of that Supreme Court decision in 1954 declaring segregated schooling unconstitutional is not been achieved, right? That's a turning point. The Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, 1964 and 1965, are further turning points. But you also see a lot of turns back towards resegregation, especially the resegregation of urban areas are actually consequent to the education decision. So I don't think it is really over.
We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. But Jill Lepore, pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Jill Lepore is the author of These Truths, A History of the United States. She's professor of American history at Harvard and staff writer for The New Yorker. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org. KQED is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Christina Kim, and Susan Britton. Senior editor is Don Zoll, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And our interns are Katie Wolf and Josh Coe, managing editor Ethan Lindsay, and executive producer Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Kress.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.